Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine. I am on the road, so that means I'm going to be depending heavily on my co-hosts, both Tim Shiflett and Catherine Smith. Welcome.
Hello, good everyone. Evening.
Yes, well, I know y'all are near the computer, so y'all can do all the fact-checking and finding things I hadn't seen. Because it's picking up a little political stuff around the South and nationally. I have just so many things, don't know where to go first. But, Catherine, you brought something to our attention that has to do with one of our frequent guests. Catherine, tell us about what you've discovered.
Well, just in the last, I guess it was Friday, our regular guest, Andre Walker, appears to have taken down his blog. Georgia Unfiltered, I think it was called, Georgia Politics Unfiltered.
Yeah, I think the domain name was like georgiaunfiltered.blogspot, and then the actual blog was Georgia Politics Unfiltered.
Yeah, and there's no, it was just taken down, and no sort of word on what he was up to or why he took it down or anything. And so, Andre, if you're out there listening, give us a call. Let us know what's going on. Did you get a gig that doesn't let you blog, or are you too busy, or what's going on? We'd love to hear from you and love to hear what the scoop is.
Yeah, because I know we talked about he blogs at Peach Pundit some, but that's been what y'all probably can actually give the exact date, but at least 2 weeks.
Oh, it's been longer than that.
Been there.
He was
longer
there.
Than that. Yeah, it was a little bit after, I believe, Barack Obama took office, because I remember one of the last posts didn't have a super pro-Democratic feel, given that, you know, he and Trevor Sutherland are the two Democratic voices on that blog.
Yeah, so, I'm just checking out and see if I can figure out when he
This is just a little weird, though, ain't it, guys? I mean, you know, all of that stuff came up. And then Andre was on our show talking about it, and he never gave any slight hint that, you know, he would just suddenly disappear from the net. So don't you think this is kind of weird?
It seems strange. I guess I did check and notice that Georgia Politics Unfiltered hadn't had a lot of action, and he does pick up a few things on that blog that other blogs don't. It makes it interesting to check in every so often.
But David, he disappeared off of Peach Pundit at the same time. I mean, he has just like the ground swallowed the guy up or something.
Yes, and I guess the last notice I had from him was I had, as part of my job as 11th District Director, I had to appoint two people, send those into Martha Kill, Jane Kidd, to the party, but Andre actually wrote a note in response to that, and that was about, say, 8-9 days ago. He's been spotted on the internet through email, but apparently he's still heading up this committee for delegate selection. So I don't know if there's any correlation, because obviously as that committee moves through, that'll be something interesting to talk about, how that process changes. But Catherine, I know you, someone in your household's on that committee, and they haven't heard from him since then either, I believe.
I believe that's correct, but there is a meeting scheduled for sometime in the next couple weeks. So maybe he's just busy, you know, getting prepared for that and really, you know, putting his efforts into that delegate selection plan. And if that's the case, you know, that's good, because I know that there are a lot of concerns about the delegate selection plan, and if that's what he's concentrating on, more power to him.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think if it that – thoroughly is going to need some, you know, looking into to make it a more open process, because I was a little miffed at the past process, but I'm sure as the changes start to come to fruition, we'll talk about that more. But just doing a little show setup, around 7:30 Eastern Standard Time, we're looking at having a guest call in for the 334. It's not 100% sure, so I don't want to preview too much because I'd hate for us to, like, the person stood us up when we're not 100% sure on the details, but it should be exciting if that comes to fruition. And then we also have a lot of topics to talk about. I guess following up on the governor's race topic from last week, we did have Mark Burkhalter rumored to be getting in that race. He is not getting in, so that race stays, I guess, at 4 on the GOP side, 1 announced on the Democratic side, although we would expect, I guess, at least 1 more on the Democratic side. Now that he's definitely not in, Tim, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, obviously, that's good news for Karen Handel, David, because Burkhalter would have taken votes from her. Plus, as we talked about last week, I really didn't think he had much of a chance because of the fundraising disadvantage going up against these heavyweights. So I think he would have been kind of drowned out. He would have been a marginal player, and he would have served to have just spoiled it for someone else, although it would have been nice to spoil anything for Karen Handel, you know.
I can't disagree with you on that one, Tim.
Yes, and I believe, isn't John Oxendine also from North Fulton?
Is he from, I thought he was from Cobb.
Cobb, yeah, I just, and I don't think his candidacy is about a geographic base, if you will, since he, you know, went from running the DeMichael Dukakis campaign from state insurance commissioner as a Republican. What a strange dynamic. By the way, speaking of that, do y'all think that Republicans in a primary will use that against him? And if they do, how effective will that be? Catherine, what do you think?
Oh, they will.
Yeah.
I would imagine. I mean, if I was them, I would.
How effective do you think it'll be?
Well, I think Oxendine is sort of the moderate, you know, there's a fair amount of Democrats who like him, and,
but he's a fair taxer, so
I know, I mean, I'm not one of them, don't get me wrong,
yeah.
I'm not one of them, but, you know, he did get some, support from more moderate Democrats when he was running for insurance commissioner against, Guy Drexinger. He had some Fulton Dems that were supporting him.
That's shocking, but that.
Well, that was a big brouhaha. But, yeah, one of them was in a television commercial.
Yeah, because I know Guy Drexinger very closely, and I think he's just a really upstanding guy.
Yeah, me too. I really liked him.
He's a good guy.
He was a great candidate too. I really liked him. In fact, he was one of the few candidates that I actually wrote checks to during that campaign.
Yeah, you know, we keep talking about Oxendine, and we know his history. He's the kind of guy that jumps in and then turns around and jumps right out. And I've got to wonder, with these other Republican heavyweights coming in the race, if Oxendine maybe is not going to be the next one to exit this race and stay right where he is.
You say chicken out again because, you know, we've talked about
this
in the past.
Yeah.
He's chickened out 4 years ago.
Yeah. And the social conservatives, they're not going to vote for him. Catherine is right about that.
Right.
He's viewed in that party as a moderate, even though we view him in a somewhat different light. So I think we really ought to watch that for a while and see what he actually winds up doing.
Oh, yeah. I've always thought the angle that he was Michael Dukakis' campaign manager would just be a killer in the Republican primary because, you know, the Republican that, you know, moved down here that doesn't vote in the primary, they're probably not going to be like Michael who? Oh, that guy from, you know, 22 years ago at that point. But the folks that, you know, really go out to vote, keep up with things.
Yeah.
Somebody
like Sadie Fields has a long memory for things like that, David. You know what I mean?
Yeah, the only thing that might make that dynamic a little bit different is if we only had one candidate on the Democratic side. So if Democrats crossed over to vote for Oxendine as the candidate. But I don't think that's going to be the case. I mean, but if that were, I think that would help him. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
but I don't think that's going to be the case.
Quite honestly, I mean, a competitive primary for dog catcher would keep me in my party instead of going over across over to you between that crowd. I mean, it's a really good choice. That's just not much of a choice there. I mean, that bunch, I mean, no, it's just something. Let's keep on governor's races. Something we alluded to last week, Arthur Davis, African-American congressman from Alabama, just a real rising star in the party, if you will. He has formally announced for governor, and this will make him, I guess they said, the second, you know, black candidate to run for Alabama governor. The first was a guy that ran as a National Democrat against George Wallace and got 15% of the vote back in, I believe, 70 or 1970, somewhere around there. But this is obviously a much more plausible, serious campaign for him to win the nomination and ultimately the governor's race. Tim, what do you think about Arthur Davis's chances and him announcing this early?
Well, he's young. He's 41 years old. He's going to run well, very obviously, in the Birmingham area, but I got to wonder where else he's going to run well in the state. I got to wonder if he's well enough known statewide, and I got to wonder if it's not one of those things where he could pull enough votes in the metro Birmingham area to possibly position himself to get the nomination with a much tougher chance of winning the general election.
Well, Tim, I will give you two other bases. One, Bruce Lee and Alabama both share one thing, is they both have a black belt, if you will, of southern part of the state. And then, of course, in Huntsville, you have a very progressive area, even though it's, you know, not very diverse. You have a lot of well-educated voters. Alabama A&M is up there with some diversity, but I think in Huntsville, I mean, you see in a very white district in the South, you know, they've elected two different congressmen now over the course of, what, two or three decades with Bud Kramer and now Parker Griffith. So I think that there's some other places. And obviously he's running a very different campaign than, you know, Charles Barkley, whoever candidacy would be. I think he's trying to run to be the governor of all of Alabama, if you will, if he does run. I mean, you see he spoke out against Reverend Wright, if you will, and that was a sign of that. The moves he's making, I guess, speak to that he's trying to be that new kind of politician, much like Harold Ford did when he ran for Senate of Tennessee and almost won.
He was an early supporter of Obama, too, wasn't he?
He was, which
yes,
I guess
he was.
In the profile he's creating, it almost goes against that profile, but then I guess he's trying to do the same thing on, and just a much tougher geography Alabama would be than the country as a whole.
Well, like I said, getting the nomination would be one thing, but man, winning a general election in that state right now, I'm not going to say.
Have a hard time.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, John McCain got way over 60% of the vote there, you know.
Oh, certainly. I mean, he has to show he's a different kind of candidate on a state level. It'd be an interesting candidacy to watch. I do think he may do well in fundraising to be competitive. And then, of course, then in all politics, it creates trickle-down. His congressional seat is the most Democratic seat in Alabama.
Right.
That's going to create an open seat. You have to wonder, does Earl Hilliard, how old seat, does he try to reclaim that seat? Even though he's been out of the spotlight for 6 years, is there new candidates? I haven't even gotten a chance to do any research there to see who looks like they might be there. If y'all happen to see Politics One and see some rumored candidates, or maybe Cheryl over there at Mooncat over at Lefton, Alabama, already has some thoughts on that. Be great if y'all happen to see that, share it at any time, maybe if we're in a different topic.
Okay, that's the 7th district, right?
It is.
Okay.
And there is, I believe, 7 over there. I guess they haven't grown or shrunk like most southern states. Most southern states have grown, Mississippi shrunk, but they seem to kind of hold firm, if you will. So I guess while you're doing your research, let's move on to the next thing. Florida Senate. Now, we've talked about Florida Senate and different candidates, but now it appears, even though Charlie Crist would have 2 years left in his second gubernatorial term, he has given serious consideration to running for U.S. Senate from Florida. Catherine, what do you think about that?
Wow.
Yeah,
I hadn't
really
heard that. That seems like a mistake to me.
What's
I mean,
he giving up, though? The
well,
lame duck part of his term.
Well, but I mean,
what
I hate
it
what,
from my perspective.
What do voters think of that, though? You know, it's his first term as governor, and he's going to...
No, this is his second term. I believe he won re-election, didn't he? He would have been elected in 2006, would he have?
Right.
So this would be, so he would actually not be doing anything. He'd just be saying, hey, I don't want my last 2 years. I stand corrected. I'm out on my last term. So he wouldn't even be shortchanging the voters, if you will.
If he's at the end of his governorship, then that seems like he'll probably do well.
You gotta remember, like Bill Clinton, he had said, oh, okay, I think I'll serve up my governor's term, but then the presidency looked like it was winnable. He ran for president, and the Republicans say, oh, he didn't serve his last 2 years as governor. Well, he was going to a different office to serve the people. That dog didn't hunt, if you will. I mean, that kind of, if people like a politician, that's usually not a very good tactic to use against him. And he's pretty popular now, which makes that seat less winnable, even though with Mel Martinez running for re-election or a different candidate that's not popular, that becomes a very competitive seat.
Exactly.
There's a couple of things to think about here. You know, Crist has been mentioned for, shall we say, a somewhat higher office. If he runs for the Senate in 10, then he abandons any national plans he has for 2012, essentially. That would be the first thing, when he could be one of the front runners for the nomination in 2012. Secondly, you talk about stirring up the pot. Lots of people are waiting to see what he does. One name I want you guys to remember, Rick Baker. He's the mayor of St. Petersburg. He's a progressive Republican, if there is such a thing anymore. And guess where he's from? Chicago. Imagine that.
I was going to guess the Florida city, Tim. I was like, eh.
No, the dude was born in Chicago, man. So remember that name, because he especially is waiting to see what Governor Crist may choose to do. And it's simple. If Crist decides he wants to run for president, then he needs to stay in the governor's office. And if he decides not, then I think he automatically becomes a clear favorite to win that Senate seat.
Yeah,
although I do think that and I don't know how many people have ever done it, if it's ever been done. But, you know, it's kind of that Evan Bayh plan, maybe the plan that Mark Warner's putting in of having gubernatorial and Senate experience for running for the presidency. You know, because Evan Bayh, I mean, he looked seriously at it, but then he said, okay, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, John Edwards, even Bill Richardson, I mean, was there really a place for Evan Bayh's candidacy? And I think he, you know, rightfully said, oh, there's probably not. But then he has that executive and Washington legislative experience, making you really one of those qualified people, and maybe that's what Crist is going for, having both experiences.
That's true, and he's only 52.
Yeah,
so
he could do a
Senate term and then run for president.
Yeah, because I really think, I mean, obviously as the nation gets older and people are healthier longer, you know, somebody being 60, 62, 65, it's not going to seem like such a big deal. People are probably, people are going to be sharp. I mean, I really think Hillary Clinton's going to run in 8 years. I really think that could happen, and she'll be in her 60s, but then
she'll be almost 70.
She'll be in her 60s.
she'll be the same age Reagan was when he got elected.
Yeah.
Don't get me started on Ronald Reagan today.
Yeah, I mean, but I think you're looking at a spire thing. I mean, obviously, I think John McCain was more with it at his age than Ronald Reagan was. I think he may have started out with more good sense from the start.
There's another thing to remember about Chris, and another reason that I think that he might be looking at national aspirations. He now has a big piece of the puzzle in place that he would need, and that is he now has a wife. We hadn't had a bachelor president since Buchanan, so, you know.
Yeah.
There's a reason for that.
Exactly.
Yeah, and if you look at historians, they say Buchanan's usually in the bottom two or three, although his marital status had nothing to do with that. That was just the fact that he sat on his hands on the brink of the Civil War. But it'll be interesting, by the way, to see historians judge presidencies in the next few years, given that they'll have the Bush presidency to fit in there between somewhere around Hoover and Buchanan. I don't know who's the third from the bottom, but I always remember looking at those. And
I think Bush will probably slug it out with Mr. Excitement, Millard Fillmore, for a spot, you know, right along in there.
Yeah, so that's what he's looking at. Well, I guess looking at, you know, Senate races, there really hasn't been a lot of action on the Georgia Senate. Have y'all heard any new news about names, or is it all who will and won't run for governor?
Yeah, I don't think people are talking about that Senate race yet until, you know, we have the governor's ticket figured out.
When Isaacson made his announcement, it was just like a door slamming, right?
Yeah, even on the Republican side, all those little, you know, Kingston, Gingrich, they're all going to line up for that.
Well, I think a big-name Democrat, David, would have been more willing to give that race a look had it been open.
Yes, and I haven't talked to the candidates, hadn't, you know, asked them, but you have to then wonder even if somebody like a Rand Knight or Del Cardwell, you know, wants to look at that again, just because, you know, some things about their candidacies were well put together, certain things, and this might be a better shot to get at it. And, you know, honestly, you just get the idea, even though Saxby Chambliss has a lot more shortcomings as far as stature, he seems to have a little more fire in the belly at times than Johnny Isaacson. And so it seems like somebody that has ambitions should take a shot at that. Y'all's thoughts?
You know, I have a lot of respect for Rand Knight and Dale Cardwell, but I really think that they would be smart to try to run for either a statewide or a, you know, more regional office first. I think they're just going to always run up against problems in a statewide, in a federal race, statewide federal race. I just think it's really difficult.
Well, the reason I mention that is it's just, if you risk something, even if it's just a state house seat somewhere, you're risking something. Whereas if you don't have elective office, you don't want to put anything up. You just go back to doing the job you were doing.
David, I was sitting here just now comparing mentally Isaacson and Chambliss and who would be harder to beat. It seemed to me that Chambliss comes across as a far more polarizing figure, whereas Isaacson is the kind of guy that might draw some crossovers.
Oh yeah, he does.
I gotta think he'd be tougher to beat than Chambliss. Not to mention the fact that Isaacson also, as you saw this week, occasionally actually gets something done in the way of legislation, where Chambliss just sits and twiddles his thumbs and runs his mouth up there.
Yeah, I do agree with that, that Isaacson has more of that bipartisan feel, even though if you put their records, voting records next to each other, I'm sure he and Chambliss vote together, you know, 90 to 95% of the time.
Yeah, but reality's not what counts, David. It's perceptions of reality.
That's right.
I've heard that in political conferences before. Perception is reality. And
right.
Well, even though Tim, of course, cut in at any point if our guest calls, but until then, let's talk. I alluded to a topic last week, and I wanted to make sure we have plenty of time to discuss it so we can actually discuss it on both ends. I'm beginning to hear talk of the city of Atlanta, the Democratic Party of Georgia, just some Democratic entities and municipal entities looking at hosting the 2012 Democratic convention. What's your first thought, Catherine, on that?
I think it would be a really good, I think it's a really good match. I think Atlanta has a really strong circuit of hotels that are convenient to the convention center. We have a lot of convention space. We have not been very competitive in the convention and trade show business lately. I think it would be a nice feather in our cap to give us some national attention. I do think we have the facilities and the facilities to handle it. And I also think that we have such, you know, a great political and social legacy here with, you know, the Carters and the Kings and, you know, all the other, you know, political things going on in Georgia. I think it would be a really, it would make me very happy as someone who's in the trade show business. But I think it would be great. I really do think it would be good. I know that 88 wasn't as successful as everyone hoped it would be. But I think we've changed since then. And I think there's a lot of things that attract people to Atlanta with the aquarium and other, you know, sort of activities that are becoming more popular in downtown Atlanta. I think it could be a really good thing.
Yes, I think there was a lot of good things about the 88 convention in Atlanta, but the number one problem with the 88 convention was the Omni. I mean, the Omni is a dump, or was a dump. You know, it's been torn down for, I guess, nearly a decade now. And it just was a small building. They weren't able to get everybody in that was supposed to get in. I believe Ted Kennedy couldn't get in one night. Because, you know, by the time you take a 16,000-seat arena, I don't know how many seats a convention system eats away, but I'd have to think it would be at least six after seeing the Fleet Center constructed. So you're talking 10, maybe less than 10,000 seats.
David, we have a caller from a 111 area code.
Well, a lot of times that's my friend Kevin Ross, but I have a feeling this is not Kevin. This is probably Michael Bridell. Welcome.
Hello?
Sir.
Hello? Hello?
You've
been, I'm on the air.
Have you unmuted him, correct?
Yes,
hello?
I have.
Is this Michael Bridell?
No, it isn't.
Who we have to call on us?
Oh, this is Mark Walker. How are you guys doing?
Good. Hi, Mark.
Doing
how are you
well.
Doing? What you got on your mind?
Well, I was just wondering. I mean, I've been listening to your show on and off, and I was just wondering, have you guys ever sucked cock or felt the touch of a man?
Oh, God.
Well, we just,
Yeah, Tim, mute this fella. This, obviously, he's not on our topic. You know, there are a lot of shows on Blog Talk Radio. Some shows have those kind of topics. And those are probably fine shows if you're looking for that. We're talking about politics, not obviously what this fellow wants. I mean, you just go in and search. Mm. You search, you know, sex, love making, whatever, and this guy will have the topic for him and the show for him to talk about.
If he's still listening, there's a couple of fine webcam chat rooms where he can both see, be seen, and talk that kind of nonsense, too. But
You know what, we really led that fellow on because he said he's listened. Obviously, last week when we were talking about Stormy Daniels and her candidacy for Louisiana Senate, that got him all excited, and so now he's wanting to talk to us about that. You know, we covered Stormy for a while, and I'm sure we'll get to come back to her Senate race, but right now we're not talking about her. Let's talk more about the convention business. Tim, you were just kind of starting to give your thoughts, I believe. Tim, go ahead.
Well, there's something to remember here about this convention angle. I mean, Shirley Franklin was one of the three co-chairs at the Denver convention. Hey, do you reckon she had a little input as to where the next convention might be or what?
Well, and that's just it. He didn't have any input into the
call. Okay, hang on, David. We have another caller.
Area code.
334.
Excellent. This is Michael Bridell, I believe. Welcome, Michael.
Yes, it is. Thank you so much. How are you doing tonight, David?
Oh, good to have you on. Michael, for those listeners that don't know, which I'm sure a lot of you do, particularly readers of Left in Alabama, Michael is running for mayor of Montgomery, Alabama. Michael, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I've been here for 10 years, came here to work at the NBC affiliate, WSFA, as an anchor and a reporter. And then in November of 2004, former Mayor Bobby Bright tapped me to be his executive assistant. So for the past 4 years, I've helped him with the day-to-day affairs of running the city. And then in November, as your listeners may know, he was elected to a seat in the U.S. Congress representing Alabama's 2nd Congressional District, and now a special election is going to be held to select his permanent successor, and I'm hoping that the voters here in Montgomery will think that I'm the right person for the job. We've got about six candidates in the race, and I'm the only one that's got hands-on experience in the day-to-day affairs of managing the city.
Yes. Now, you said you came to Montgomery as a television reporter. We've noticed this a lot more in the South. Del Cardwell was at WSB Atlanta, ran for U.S. Senate. Helen Moreno was at a television station in New Orleans, ran for Congress. What kind of special insight do you gain from doing television reporting in a city?
Absolutely. I was going to say everything and then nothing. Television is almost like the allegory of Plato's cave. You will see the superficial workings of a government, but once I actually got in there and got my hands hands on the process, there is so much more stuff going on to keep a city operational. A lot of people think that government can run like a business, or they've got different clues of how government could run better, but it's a lot more complex. Of course, if you are a journalist and you do sponsor or specialize in covering government, you do get perhaps a little bit more insight than the typical citizen, but still, it was an eye-opener for me to come to the city and start handling the day-to-day affairs.
Yes, and as soon as you announced your campaign, or maybe even before, Congressman Bright announced or endorsed the campaign and got on board. What do you think caused that?
I hope that he took that as a validation of the years of service that I gave him in running the city. The position involved oversight of 7 municipal departments, the police, the fire, EMA, the folks who call answer 911 calls, along with the museum, the library, the zoo, food services, and a ton of other special projects and handling constituent concerns. And I believe the endorsement was a validation of the years of service that I gave to the congressman.
Yes. Now, Montgomery, Alabama, I've visited there once in the last few years, and yes, I know. It's a beautiful city, but two things strike you right off. One is you see this one set of history. It's the, Confederate Capitol with the Confederate White House. And then the other side is Rosa Parks, the Montgomery bus boycott, Martin Luther King's church in Montgomery, these two histories, which at times clash. You being African-American, and running for mayor, how is that important to be able to bring the city together?
I believe the city has come together a lot, especially under Congressman Bright's 9 years in office. He really was a bridge builder. He made government more representative of the citizens. In terms of us being the seat for two of the most significant historical movements in the country, that's something that Montgomery boasts its chest out with pride. Our city seal says that we're the cradle of the Confederacy and the birthplace of the civil rights movement, and we've been pretty proactive in recent years in capitalizing on that for tourism efforts. But there definitely is a spirit of community here. Montgomery realizes that we're facing the same problems that other urban areas are across the country, and the only way we'll be able to make real lasting progress and attain solutions is if we cast aside our differences and work together as one great city.
Yes, well, the Kudzu Vine's not a one-man show. Catherine Smith and Tim Shiflett also co-host. Catherine, I'm going to turn the questions over to you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much for joining us tonight, Mr. Bredell. We really appreciate it. I'm a big fan of Montgomery myself, so I'm glad to have you here. I'm just wondering, you know, I live in Atlanta, so I know a lot about the, you know, troubles facing the bigger urban areas. But what are the challenges that you see facing Montgomery in the next, you know, say the term that your first term would be? What kind of challenges are you concerned about and prepared for to handle?
Catherine, the main issue that's going to face the next mayor, and it's going to hit him, and I can say him because all of the candidates in the race are male, is our city's declining sales tax revenues. We're seeing people spend less, and 50% of our city budget used to be made up of the 3.5 cents on every dollar that was purchased. We had declining revenues for probably most of the past 18 to 20 months, not seeing an increase in those sales tax revenues. So that's going to possibly impact in a big way our ability to deliver the city services that Montgomeryans expect and deserve. We're also looking at some annexation issues with a nearby town that is trying to annex profitable land where new retailers are coming in. In fact, that's going to be headed to the state Supreme Court to be resolved. But those are the two big issues right there, trying to make up for those lost revenues or at least reduce the size of our government so that we're able to function with the revenues that are coming in, and then also the boundaries of the city on its east side.
Well, those are big challenges. I think we're all facing, you know, that with the economic situation the way it is, we're all facing those. How's the employment situation in Montgomery?
Well, because we are the state capital, we've got relatively a stable employment picture. We've got state government. We've got gigantic medical systems here in place, and also Maxwell and Gunter Air Force Base are here as well. We're blessed to be the home of Hyundai here in North America, even though the decrease in sales had forced the company to reduce its production schedule, which then had a trickle-down effect for all of the suppliers. But the good news is Hyundai sales most recently have had an uptick, and we're hoping real soon that they will increase their production so that those workers can get the normal paychecks that they've been accustomed to. But employment-wise, because of our diversity and because of state government, the military, the hospitals, and automotive, we're faring a lot better than many other cities in the Southeast.
Well, I hope that continues. I applaud your efforts to diversify your commerce because I think that's very important. Tim, you want to go ahead?
Thank you, Catherine. Mr. Bredell, you were one of the last
Michael,
candidates. Oh, yes, sir. Michael, you were one of the last candidates to enter the race. Why was that, and did that put you at a disadvantage in things like fundraising, for instance?
I was one of the last candidates because I was still the executive assistant after the November election, and there were a lot of loose ends and unfinished projects and business that we needed to get sewn up before Congressman Bright left City Hall at the end of December to go up to Washington to take his oath of office. As a result, I didn't really start campaigning full-time until January 20th, as a matter of fact. The day of the inauguration was my last day before I took a leave of absence. We're playing catch-up, but I'm encouraged by the response that I've gotten now that I've devoted all of my energies to the campaign. We're going to try to catch up in the fundraising department, but the responses we've got thus far have been very encouraging.
Okay, and the other question I wanted to ask you, you've kind of alluded to this already, but Montgomery really was the birthplace of the civil rights movement. If you could point to one place, that had to be it. Montgomery is majority African-American, yet they have never elected an African-American mayor. I know you've probably been asked this question before, but for those that do not live in the Alabama area, tell us why you think that is.
It's hard to say. The 2000 census had the African-American population pegged at about 48%, the white population at 46%. So blacks did not technically make up a majority. Definitely they were the biggest group, but it was pretty much a coin flip, 50-50. Even though blacks may have a bigger representation in the general population, the numbers skew towards the younger side. So a lot of African Americans are under the age of 18 and were unable to vote. Also, I suspect there might have been some distrust in the government process. I mean, the legacy of the syphilis experiment in Tuskegee still is very real, very tangible to a lot of blacks who live in central Alabama, and that might have discouraged people from wanting to register and vote. So a number of things have probably come into play to keep African Americans out of the city hall office at the top spot.
Okay, thank you, sir. David?
Well, Michael, we thank you for coming on with us. One thing we always like to do is give you a chance if somebody's heard you and they want to get involved in your campaign. What are the ways they can do that?
Well, since we're over the Internet, the best thing to do would be to go to the website, and that is www.bridell, and that's a hard last name to spell, but it's B as in boy, R-I, D as in David, D, E-L-L, the number 4, mayor.com, and they'll be able to find all of our contact information, including how to contribute online if anyone has the desire to ensure that good government is preserved here in the city of Montgomery.
Yes, well, we're going to be watching this race. We watch races all across the South and see how this comes out. So the process will be, like most races, is it going to be where the top two go to a runoff? And then from there, it's the elected, or is it plurality wins on the first ballot?
If necessary, there will be a runoff if the top vote getter fails to get 50% plus one, and that general election will take place in 30 days, March the 10th. If there is no outright winner, then the runoff will take place April the 21st. So I've got either 4 more weeks of campaigning or 10 more weeks of campaigning. The voters will decide for us on March the 10th.
Yes. Well, we'll be watching that race closely if this is the mayoral year. And we let you off the hook. We didn't ask you tough questions about Auburn football or anything like that.
Well, Dave, I got to confess, I'm a native of Philadelphia, so my heart pumps Eagle Green blood. I like Auburn. I like Alabama. I wish that they both could have successful seasons, but I haven't yet chosen a dog in that fight yet.
Yes, we just know Montgomery is just a stone's throw from the campus over there, so I just thought I'd bring it up. But thanks again for coming on with us.
Thank you, and guys, I've enjoyed listening to the show. Before I called in, keep up the great work, and we'll be back in touch.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yes, just another well-prepared candidate. I always love when these candidates come on and talk with us. And these municipal races, really, I mean, we're talking just this year it's going to be. I know all three capitals of the southern states cross here, Atlanta, Montgomery, Jackson, all going to have mayor's races. And then I'm sure there's, you know, many other cities throughout the South that are going to have the same. And we're going to keep trying to get candidates. If you're a candidate or a campaign manager or just a supporter and you want your candidate on, please let us know. You can send us a message through the page, or you can email me at davidelect2.com, because obviously there's some candidates I have, you know, really good access to, and I like bringing them on, but I don't want to just exclude other folks. So, you know, feel free to let us know. But I guess we were talking about the convention in Atlanta. Tim, final word on that before we go to the outrage.
Well, like I said, with Shirley Franklin, you know, putting her 2 cents worth in, I think we got a better than average shot at the convention. And in looking over the blogosphere, and I know Catherine's been looking around too, a lot of Republicans are talking about Atlanta as a possibility for the Republican National Convention. Wouldn't it be something if we had both conventions there?
Ay, ay, ay.
Yeah, it would be great economically, but then I don't know. I don't know if one city can handle all that.
Well, they were weren't they both in New York in 2000? Oh, no, they were in New York.
No, no, the Democratic Party thought about it, but we went to Boston in 2004, and that was the right move. I mean, Boston, that's where those planes took off from. I mean, it was actually, I don't think that's why they went there, but it actually had a nice feel to it being John Kerry's home state. I think the Democratic Party and probably the Republican Party now is now trying to say, hey, let's not just keep locking down our base and going to a city that loves us. Let's see if we can expand the map. And I think that's one thing that will also be attractive about Georgia. If you look at a southern state that could possibly flip, Georgia's the next one. I mean, if Virginia,
right,
and North Carolina already have, although in Florida I wouldn't, you know, say we've locked them down forever, but the next one to fall would be Georgia before you go to a Mississippi, Tennessee, and Alabama.
David, from your lips to God's ears.
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. I mean, I see that. Well, Tim, go ahead with your outrage.
Okay, this one's kind of involved in a lot of money figures and stuff thrown in, so y'all bear with me here. And it's going to begin with my state senator, Jeff Mullis. He's pushing a plan that would result in the construction of a high-speed rail system between the Chattanooga and Atlanta airports if the plan gets full funding. Now, in normal economic circumstances, I suppose this would be a good idea. So, Senator Mullis, don't call me and tell me that I'm not supporting this, because I would if the economy was good, okay? Okay, now let's move along. But obviously, like I just said, we ain't there in normal economic circumstances. So I got to doing some checking in hopes of finding out where the money for such a thing would come from. Now, quite obviously, the state doesn't have it. Last time I checked, we're facing a budget shortfall this year of over $2 billion, and even more than that for the next fiscal year. And they ain't going to raise the full amount of the money anywhere else in Georgia, since they're giving out over $250 million in tax breaks to in-state corporations like Delta Airlines, for instance. Now, I did read, though, that the Republican legislature was going to do a little creative, shall we say, bill swapping that's going to cost every homeowner some money. They have trumpeted they're raising the homestead exemption from $2,000 to $4,000. What they didn't brag about, though, is their plan to do away with the state homeowners grant. So I'm trading a $75 saving in one bill for a $300 loss in another. But even at that won't provide the extra funds for the state's part of the rapid rail idea either, much less balance the state's budget. And so they're cutting and cutting more services, but that isn't doing it either. While they're cutting, revenues are dropping. Tax revenue dropped by 14% in January alone. So we get back to my original question. Just where is the money for the state budget, along with pet projects like that of my state senators, coming from? Then I heard something else of interest this very week. Seems like the legislature is about to enter a period of, shall we say, reduced work weeks. Many of these weeks, they're going to work only 3 days, so that on March 25th, when they would normally be finished for the year, they'll still have 5 of the 40-day session left to work. And so their plan is to come back for these 5 days in June. Now, just guess why they're doing that. Well, seems like they want to use that time to decide how to spend any stimulus money that might be coming their way. Now, let me get this straight. The entire Republican congressional delegation in Georgia, 7 House members and 2 senators, are all opposed to the stimulus plan. The state Republican Party, led by self-appointed spokesperson Sadie Fields, the mouth of the South, well, they hate it too. The GOP legislative leadership is all bad-mouthing it to a man in the newspapers. But yet, there they'll be in June, dividing the money up like a bunch of cheap bank robbers. Now, they all say they're opposing this stimulus on philosophical grounds. They say they have principles to stand on. Of course, their principles will take a back seat in June, won't they? When it comes time to divvy up the goodies, I'll bet that Sonny Perdue, Casey Cagle, Glenn Richardson and Eric Johnson will break their necks to be the first hogs feeding at the trough. And my state senator, oh, he's going to be there too. Get this. This elevated high-speed railway he's working on just happens to fall under the protection of the Transportation Committee, which he happens to be the chairman of. This elevated rail line, which will have a bullet train capable of 300 mile per hour speeds, comes in at the nifty price of about $4.5 billion. Construction alone amounts to about $25 million per mile in rural areas and much more in Atlanta. And you can bet your last dollar that he'll petition the federal government to pay for as much of this as possible. Oh, and I might also add here that Senator Mullis introduced a bill to raise $850 million in the form of a sales tax, yes, a tax increase, to get this project off the ground. That would be paid for largely by the taxpayers in the 10 counties around Atlanta that this train would travel to. This Republican legislature and Republican governor are just comical to me. They're going to oppose this stimulus to please their base, but they'll quickly take the money offered by the evil Democrats and their socialist president. Casey Cagle and Glenn Richardson both want to be governor. Eric Johnson wants to be lieutenant governor. Jeff Mullis may have designs on a congressional seat. I think he does. And Sonny Perdue might want to be a U.S. senator in the future or have even higher aspirations. Yeah, they'll grab the money. Political power is at stake, and that's where their real principles are. So, I have a favor to ask of this bunch. Please pass Senate Bill 16. That would allow Sunday statewide sales of alcohol with this legislature. I really do need more to drink, David.
Tim, great outrage, but I do have a question. When did being commissioner of the Pro Bass Fishing Association become a higher status job than a U.S. senator?
No comment.
It's crazy how that the Republicans, you know, oppose this. I saw, you know, we're talking about Kathy Cox, state school superintendent. You know, she was opposed to the education funds, and some of that would have been, you know, construction of building of new schools. And we know, like in the metro Atlanta area and the areas we live in, you know, we can actually raise sales tax funds to build new schools, and so it's not dire. But there are places in South Georgia that, you know, they don't have a shopping mall. They probably don't have a Walmart or a Kmart to raise sales tax funds to do a splosh to build a new school. They need new buildings. I mean, couldn't Kathy Cox have been supportive of that funding, and she opposed the bill, that part of the bill, and the Republicans nationally cut it out?
Listen, David, you know what they're having to do? They're having to walk a tightrope, these Republicans are. Their base, led by Miss Fields, is screaming, oppose this thing. And yet at the same time, they're going to stick their hands out as quietly as they can and get any money and other help that's coming their way. They've got to. The state budget is in an absolute shambles. Now, get this. The state of California has the highest budget deficit of any state. That's no surprise. You know who number two is? Hey, it's Georgia.
I was thinking you were getting there because, and obviously, you know, we're one of the top 10 population states. Are we number 9 or 10 in population? That seems to move around a bit. I know we're safely in the top 10, but.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
But yes, but that does show some mismanagement because it should be, you know, Texas, New York, Illinois, which are all one of those.
Yeah, states, right.
You know, good bit bigger than some population.
And Republicans run the state, folks, so there's only one place to point your finger here.
Yes, I mean, we haven't had control of anything in, you know, 6+ years for the governor's office and the state senate, 4 from the House, and, you know, there's just no way you can blame us. I will say this, I think the Republicans have tried to blame us on the state level because they obviously realize there's just nothing there. But speaking of state Democratic politics, don't forget next week, or I may be announcing it the first time, David Poitras will be our special guest, so tune into that. I think we've planned for him to come on pretty early in the show to have an interview in the front part. No telling what else will line up, but only announced Democratic gubernatorial candidate. He did join us at the Wild Hog Supper, but this will be that extended interview, and we'll start doing more of these. Also, I did want to mention keep listening to Game On right now. It's at Tuesdays at 8 o'clock. But some big things are happening there. Kevin and I are having a lot of discussions. One, we always try to have discussions to make the show better. And if you want to hear more national politics, don't forget that. But, Catherine, tell us what you think about the stimulus bill and the Republicans' duplicity, if you will, on it.
You know, I go back and forth about the best solution to these problems, and I wish that we didn't have to do this. I think we all wish we didn't have to do this, but I just don't see another path. I mean, I'm not an economist, though my father was. But I'm just really disgusted by the Republicans' unwillingness to support it, but not have a really legitimate alternate solution. It's just
right.
It's very it's really partisan politics at its worst. When
right.
people are suffering across the country, you know, small
Amen.
Businesses are suffering. Our business has seen a real downturn in revenue. We had to do some staff adjustments this week. It's real, you know, people are suffering, and for them to sit on their duffs and not take action is really shameful, in my opinion.
Yes, and obviously, you know, they want to claim tax cuts, but Bush put in the wealth, you know, tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans, and that's what helped create the deficit. That's the biggest thing, and I've said it on the national show. If you're not in such a deep, you know, debt and deficit as we are, if we'd have kept on the Clinton plan, then if we did incur these deficits for a short time to regenerate the economy, it wouldn't be, you know, near as big a deal. Now, you know, also I would probably argue that you wouldn't have been in this economy had you not had the mess, because there's an article I read back in like 1992, and it talked about the trickle-up theory, if you will, and what it says is, rich people have the ability to make money. So what happens is, you know, poor and middle-class families, they take the money, they spend it, and the money trickles up. And if there's no way to get the money away from the richest of the rich to go back down, the cycle of economics will dry up.
Oh, yeah.
So
it's
have
the,
to have
the trickle-down is a myth. It's a myth.
Yeah. It trickles up because, you know, the average, you know, person has no way of making money. They just get their paycheck, but they don't, you know, make big sums of capital, if you will. So,
hey,
but
hey, David, one point I want to make before we go. I noticed these Republicans have no objection to higher sales taxes, though, do they?
No, for some reason
Ew.
They like inequitable taxes, but equitable
right.
taxes they're no fan of. But been a great show, and I want to thank Michael Bridell for coming on again, running for mayor of Montgomery, Alabama, and look forward to seeing you on the, or hearing, being with you next week on the show.
Thank you, David. Thank you, Tim.
Good night.
Good night.